Listen to the new Thin Green Line podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Game wardens John Norris and Wayne Saunders talk about wildlife, the outdoors, law enforcement, environmental subjects mixed with current events and guests that are part of the Thin Green Line. And if you are one of those visual people, like me, for $5 a month, you can see the actual podcast on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com and join us.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, episode 54, The Case of Kate Matrosova. This podcast is actually an interview with the author, Ty Gagne, who wrote the book about Kate Matrosova. The title of the book is Where You Will Find Me. This podcast, I will tell you, has been a soul searcher. As the lieutenant in charge of this search and rescue mission, there is a lot of ins and outs, ups and downs. The stress comes back to me years later. Search and rescue is part of the New Hampshire conservation officer's job and a large part of it in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. You're going to hear very clear descriptions that Ty talks about and I talk about regarding this case. We're going to continue on with a little mini series here. The next podcast is going to be interviews with some of the game wardens that were there and how they handled the situation, what they did right, what they did wrong. Really eye-opening for me to reflect back on such a case. John Norris isn't joining us this week. He is on the road. He's with Monster Energy and Can-Am in the desert somewhere and on some undisclosed location doing a little racing. So hopefully when he joins us back, he'll share what he's been up to lately. But this is going to be a little series, like I said, talking about this case. It's so different being a part of this interview myself, as well as being the host, to reflect back, to have the insight, to have this book written, to be in the book, to be part of the mission. And it was such a case that affected so many people in so many ways. And I just wanted to share that. And by framing it with the interview from Ty Gagne about the book, and then bring the officers into it so you can hear what they experience. Certainly, our search and rescue teams are outstanding, and we'll talk about the Mountain Rescue Service, AVSAR, the skill sets they have, and the people that they bring to bear on search and rescue in the highest quality. I always think of those teams that we need to call that are trained above and beyond what we are as the Delta Force, the Navy SEALs of search and rescue. And that's what we needed in this case, in this Kate Matrosova case. And we'll talk about them, and hopefully we'll get to share a little about what went on there. So this is the first part to give you an overview with Ty Gagne's book, Where You'll Find Me. Then we'll go into some officer interviews as we continue on this little series of the case of Kate Matrosova. And if you are listening to Warden's Watch, please, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, if you guys could just put a review out there. Having a five-star review helps other listeners as they look for outdoor podcasts, as they look, we have a five-star rating, and that there is a bunch of people that give it a five-star rating, just not, you know, a few. So that helps us. If you could do that, take some time out of your day. If you enjoy the Warden's Watch podcast, which I hope you do, if you're listening, I hope you do. We certainly have a diverse group that we've interviewed from across the country, and we're going to continue with that. I got some exciting stuff coming up. We're going to go across the pond in one of the most recent interviews that I did, and we're going to go to Washington State in future ones. So, but we're going to continue first with this episode 54, The Case of Matrosova, featuring Ty Gagne, the author of Where You'll Find Me. Thanks for listening. I remember my sergeant keep coming in and asking about Ty Gagne, asking this, asking that. He wants to meet with us and talk about Kate Matrosova. And I was like, who is this guy anyways? And Mark and you had a relationship. You guys were friends. And, you know, and he wanted, he's like, oh, he does risk management. And so that kind of framed our first meeting, was talking about the Kate Matrosova case that we're going to talk a lot about. But the risk, the management, and the lessons learned. For those that are going to listen to this and read your book, because that's so important when we have travesty, that we take the good, at least that's what I've found, to take the good out of it, take the learning process out of it, and pass it on, because that's Kate's legacy.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember meeting you for the first time vividly. I think we were having lunch in Lancaster,
yes.
Mark and I, and I knew who you were, but we had never met. And, you know, I was in law enforcement, as you know, long ago. And I can remember sitting across the table from you. And I'm like, yeah, this guy isn't, he's, I'm still getting measured up here.
You're so, still getting measured up, yeah. for sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, years ago. But, yeah, those first meetings are critical. And
yeah.
The framework, I think all law enforcement officers know that. You can't judge a book by its cover, but that's the place to start. Mm-hmm. And we start peeling back the onion, so to speak, to see, you know, what kind of people are made of. It's just, it's in our DNA.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, some don't take the time to peel back the layers and, yeah.
And I have learned that through my career that, yeah, you can't judge a book by its cover. It's a good place to start, but you need to peel back those layers to find out who people are. Cause there are some really awesome people that sometimes we don't give the time of day because of the way they look, the way they talk. And it's just, it's been a learning experience. So, but yeah, and we all measure each other up, and that's why it's so important when law enforcement have those civilian friends that can actually
around right. balance. You. Absolutely. And so, congrats on the podcast.
Yeah. It's been fun. It's keeping me engaged in what I love to do.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what I'd do otherwise. You know, after retirement, it felt like I jumped off a cliff and I was just waiting to land. And I'm like, I better pull a parachute here quick.
Well, you landed. You landed well.
And it's really unique to go back to cases, to rescues that I've been involved with directly. And this one is really, you know, close to my heart because it was a tragedy. It was over the top. It was on the edge. Her husband, Charlie, you know, I worked with him to the much of a degree as a search and rescue manager works with a husband of a tragic event. So it's part of me, but again, you bring it into paper so people can read. And it's so important for people to understand so they don't make the same mistakes and they learn from it. So that's Kate's legacy. I mean, she was quite a dynamic woman, I found out after the fact. And when my phone wouldn't stop ringing, every time I set it down after the search mission, it rang again. And finally, I had to Google Kate Matrosova and to see what an accomplished woman she was. And then your idea of risk management. And, you know, Ty also does talks about this incident and talks about his books. And I've listened to 5 different times that Ty's gone to these events and spoken to groups. And each time, I find it engaging. I find it interesting. For the 5th time, it just blows my mind that you could do that 5 different times, 5 different ways, and engage somebody that actually was there and lived it to the point where I'm interested and it goes quickly.
Yeah, thanks. My approach with this has always been, and to use your words, it was a tragedy. And I think, you know, we're quick to judge people, especially when something goes wrong. And I always approach this from the perspective of when we judge, we stop learning. And let's take a different approach to this. What can we take away from a tragic situation that might help us better manage risk or better understand our own decision-making process on a day-to-day basis? Because, you know, the things that tend to go wrong in the mountains are the same things on a day-to-day basis that can go wrong for us at sea level. And again, try to create a resource for people.
Yeah.
Also telling the story of a really remarkable person and exceptional human beings that go out into the backcountry to rescue them.
Right. And then they apply it to their lives, their work. So, because you're a risk manager.
Yeah.
That's what you do for work.
Yeah. Who also takes a few from time to time, because I do think there's value in doing that.
But, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you also are an outdoors person. You hike, you do winter hikes. You know, so that was interesting to you, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, I had my own mishap or near mishap in the mountains in 2008, which I'm very transparent about. It's the prologue of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gone on to Franconia Ridge on a February weekend and with two people I had never hiked with before, but I was really drawn. I really wanted to do the ridgeline. You know, and I talk about those things that influence us to do some of the things that we do. You know, I was going kind of on ego. And it wasn't the day to be out there. They weren't the people to be with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't with my normal hiking and climbing partner. And, you know, I made a series of decisions, as we all do, that ended up, it could have been very high consequence, but luckily I got through really high winds and really poor visibility on the ridge. And, you know, I reflected a lot on that. And I think that has helped shape how I approach these things, because it can happen to anybody. It doesn't have to be at 4,000 or 5,000 feet. Again, it can be driving your car or, you know, at work. It just doesn't really matter.
Yep. And I get it, because I'm a goal oriented person as mm-hmm. well. I remember a similar thing hiking Mount Jefferson. It was like May. And again, I just threw a few things in the backpack, and I always threw my, you know, first aid stuff and things that I normally carry along with a radio back then.
Mm-hmm.
Just to hike Mount Jefferson, and I got up there and the clouds came in and it got cold, and I'm like, I didn't bring enough, and I'm sitting there, I'm going to the top.
Yeah, did you keep going?
Oh, yeah, of course I did.
Right.
Of course I did. I just, you know, and it broke again and it was fine. As you know, the whites, you know, blink and they'll change the weather again.
Yeah.
But again, I should have just one extra layer, I would have been fine. But nope, Wayne, you do this all the time. You know what you need, and it's a gorgeous day there. Yeah, it was a gorgeous day, and then those clouds came in. Temperatures dropped like 10 degrees, in within 20 minutes.
Yeah, and I think what I tried to do with the book and what I've tried to do with the presentations is, you know, these are the things that, this is why Wayne continues to move toward the summit
mm-hmm.
when all of these seemingly inconsequential things are happening, and they're stacking on top of each other until you sprain your ankle, or you get disoriented or lost, or you're dehydrated or hypothermic. And
exactly. And you start making poor decisions. It
falls apart.
Mm-hmm. No, it's because you can put yourself in their shoes. And, you know, that day I was going to the top, and I knew it. And, you know, it cleared out. It was a nice day. It was a beautiful day at the top once I got there, but I didn't expect that cloud bank to roll in. And I can certainly understand when people come up from Boston, New York, and it's in their schedule.
Yeah,
I don't know how many rescues I've done that it's in their schedule.
Yeah, so that's a decision bias. It's sunk cost effect. And, you know, we get a finite period of time to go accomplish the goal we've set for ourselves. And even though we're getting all of these signs and signals that it might not be the right day, or we're running out of time, or it's getting late, we'll continue to escalate our commitment toward the summit or the goal, not really paying attention to the fact that we need to be reassessing. And again, we've put so much time, energy, and money into this endeavor, and I can't come back the next weekend because I've got plans, so mm-hmm. I've got to go. I've got to keep going.
And that's right.
Then you get your phone rings.
Mm-hmm. And that's because we've been there, we can make that assessment.
Right.
And
and hopefully learn from that. And unfortunately, Kate made the same type of assessments just on one of the worst weather days in my recollection.
Yeah.
I mean, when it's negative 90 with a wind chill, you know, on Mount Adams, is just beyond extreme. The second coldest place on Earth.
Yeah, 90 below zero overnight. They wind gust at 5:30 in the morning the Monday, just before the second phase of the search was starting. They got a gust of 141.
Mm.
I think the only other coldest place on Earth was Antarctica at the time.
Yes. Just that's just incredible to think that happened in northern New Hampshire.
Right.
And to be honest with you, most people just, you know, I don't know how many times they see that sign, you know, Mount Washington, world's worst weather. And they think it's funny. They take pictures beside it. And they just don't understand. I mean, I've been there. I've seen that. I've seen the winds. You know, sitting in a cruiser when you can't open the doors because the winds are so crazy. Being on Mount Washington where you can't see your hand in front of your face and you got to get off this mountain to get just back because you're done on top and you're driving 2 miles an hour trying to get off the road. So I get it. And, you know, actually, one of the podcasts I've done before that, we talked, me and Jim Sears. Jim Sears, game warden in northern New Hampshire, spent some time on the top of Mount Washington. And Mike Pelchek is another guy I hope I get an opportunity to talk, because he knows a lot about Mount Washington and a lot about search and rescue.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time up there, just search and rescue, and as, you know, former park manager,
search and rescue person for eons.
Yeah, great guy.
I'm plugging that next podcast for him. So this one's going to come on before Mike does. Or he's going to be part of this one maybe as well.
I hope he is. He's got a lot to offer.
He certainly has a lot to offer. So, but, you know, let's frame this book. I mean, you know, I was there. I lived part of it. But, you know, it's nice to get somebody that's done all the interviews and put everything as a package together. Because mine's one perspective. You have many perspectives looking from the outside in, which I find, you know, it's really engaging for even me.
Yeah. Where would you like to start, you think?
Let's start at the beginning.
Yeah. So, well, I think the beginning really is Kate arrived in the United States right around 20 years old, from Omsk, Siberia. She came over here on a work-study visa, spent some time working, ended up moving to Illinois, attended college. She was learning English at the time, and graduated with a four-year degree from DePaul, you know, scored a really competitive internship on Wall Street. From there, earned her graduate degree in financial engineering, worked for the fourth largest investment bank in the world, also located on Wall Street. And over a period of 4 years prior to her accident in February of 15, you know, she had climbed some pretty significant summits throughout the world. She climbed Denali, Rainier, Elbrus, Kilimanjaro, Aconcagua. She was planning to do Everest. She was on her way to completing the seven summit challenge. She had already done four. It's the highest summit on each of the seven continents. And each of those times that she did that, she was, you know, she was a client in a guided expedition, where really the guides, the experts, are assuming the decision making for the client.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the things that we think about is, does that experience equate to the experience that's necessary to tackle something like the White Mountains, which may, you know, seem like such a small endeavor compared to the, you know, 22,000-foot mountain. Yeah.
Nope, I would agree. And you're right. From my perspective, I would call her experienced, mm-hmm. just because she has done all that. Even with a guide, you pick up the skill sets. You're building your skill sets. But those guides know their individual areas. They know their routes. They know their weather. They keep an eye on that stuff, and they keep it serious. And we have the same type of guide in the White Mountains, especially during the winter areas that they take groups up there.
Yeah, they're hyper-focused on managing risk. The safety of the client is paramount. And so in January of 2015, Kate and Charlie had come up to the White Mountains for her to do reconnaissance on the route, because she knew she was going to be coming back in February. Originally did not want to do the hike solo. That wasn't her intention, mm-hmm. but she couldn't get anybody to go with her. So she decided, you know, I'm going to do this. She saw this as progression. She saw this as an opportunity to gain experience,
mm-hmm.
To build resiliency. She liked to suffer. She saw growth in suffering in that, you know, putting yourself in a situation and working really hard and drawing lessons from that. And so the January trip, when they came up, they had hiked Madison together, stayed overnight. Kate wanted to go do Mount Adams the next morning. You know, Charlie didn't want to continue, thought that, sensed that the weather was probably going to turn, which, as you said in your earlier comments, that it's very quick to do that in the blink of an eye. And so they broke down camp, returned back to New York knowing she'd come back a month later. So over President's Day weekend, her intent was to do the Northern Traverse. It's around 15 miles. It starts at Mount Madison Valley Way Trail and culminates just past Mount Washington in Ammonoosuc Ravine. And so her intent was to get a very early start that Sunday and to do the traverse. But as you said, some really, really bad weather arrived late morning into the afternoon, and she was out there in it and just was unable to get out of it.
Right, and she had a very aggressive itinerary as well. I remember, you know, looking at her time frames and how she framed it and going, that was pretty aggressive, you know, especially for the winter. And she broke trail a lot of the way. So it took so much energy to get above tree line to start. Because if anybody has experienced even snowshoeing or operating in snow, when you're breaking trail, you always want somebody in front of you breaking trail. And it always kills me because canines understand this. If you have a dog, all of a sudden it's heavy snow, and you watch that dog. He may do it for a few minutes, but then he's behind you because you're breaking the trail.
Yeah.
And I'm like, those dogs are so smart. And here I am breaking trail for him, and every now and then he's stepping on my snowshoes, and I'm getting, get off my snowshoes, you know? Yeah.
Well, and as you know, from a search and rescue standpoint, fishing game is generally breaking the trail. They're the hasty teams that are going up first and creating that trough for the other teams that are coming to support.
And that's so important because half the energy is expanded, you know, by breaking trail.
Yeah.
So by her, just that initial part, it probably took a whole lot more out of her than she thought.
Yeah, it took a lot of time. Definitely. You can just watch because I have, thanks to Fishing Game, I have the GPS track. She had a handheld GPS and have been able to use that to just ascertain where Kate was at what particular time, and then you cross-reference that with the weather, hourly weather observations from the observatory, so you get a sense of direction of wind, temperature, and where she was, and that's really helped tell the story because, you know, unfortunately, she didn't survive and is unable to, you know, to explain what she was doing, why she decided to do what she did.
And that's something really good when you do your talks. That's something you talk about, where she was, what the weather, how it was changing, you know, and decisions upon that point. So I found that interesting when you talk because you have that timeline that frames it out, and the weather reports that go consistently, the winds. You can almost start to feel you as somebody listening to you experiencing that. And I think that's your goal, is to have your audience experience what Kate was experiencing.
I think as best I can, you know, recognizing until you've been in a 70 plus mile an hour wind, which I think we both have at some point, it's just a completely different ballgame. It's exhausting. And then you exacerbate it with wind chill and high, you know, whether you're hydrating or eating, providing that, you know, keeping your glycogen stores where they need to be for the exertion that you're in, the output that you're engaged in.
And that's very difficult to do in the wintertime.
It is.
You actually have to make yourself eat and drink because that you don't want to get that out, and you don't want to, and something inside you says you don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to take too much effort to eat and drink.
But that's just one of those, it's easier not to stop and take your pack off.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just one of those inconsequential things, one of those small variables that, again, it doesn't seem important to you at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But when something goes wrong, it's just one more thing that has to be managed in a situation you got to untangle yourself from.
Yeah, and your body's using all those stores, breaking trail, getting above tree line. And when you break up tree line, there's that, I'm here.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It is awesome.
It is. It's just something, especially on a sunny day. It's just, there's nothing like it, being on that ridgeline on a sunny day and experiencing that.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah. It's so she breaks tree line, and she's achievement.
Yeah.
We've got it. We're here. So, but now I have my itinerary. And at that point, when she breaks tree line, you know, the weather's getting bad, but not real bad. And it's at her back, too, the wind.
Yeah. When she got out of the car at the trailhead, you know, there was no wind. It was 0 degrees. And some of the listeners might be like, well, it's still cold. But not, you know, not if you're a winter hiker with some experience and you got the proper gear. Mm-hmm. She actually felt it was warmer than what she expected it to be. And so, you know, you talk about when you have an expectation that something's going to be a certain way and it's actually more favorable than what you expect, that contributes to, that adds complexity to decision-making that you're going to have to engage in later on. And so when she broke tree line at around 8:50 in the morning, the wind was at her back. It was, you know, it was cold, but again, she had the gear for that type of weather at the time. And the weather didn't really start to shift, I'd say, until around 10:30 in the morning. It stayed pretty stable from 8:50 to around 10:30. But it really, right around 10:30 in the morning is when that critical decision came as to whether she's standing down in front of Madison Hut. And, you know, that's the link up back to the Valley Way Trail or to continue Star Lake, which was her intended itinerary. And that's, you know, the moment of decision. Do you call it a day? Because, you know, the winds at that point were starting to gust up to, you know, between 60 and 70 miles an hour. Or do you continue going? And she chose to continue going. We will never know why. But again, the approach I wanted to take was what are some of the things that cause us to continue? Mm-hmm. Just what kept Wayne going up Jefferson? What are those decision biases that keep people out there?
Right. And it's in our DNA is my explanation, you know, where those types of people are goal achievers and we set our goals and it's very difficult for us to slack off from that until we hit that. You know, whether you're a runner, whether you're, no matter what you're competing in or what everything, that's your goal is to win that, to achieve that, to get that title, to get that, you know. So that's in a lot of people's DNA. And I covered a lot of rescues because of that DNA throughout my career.
Yeah. I mean, I think drive and determination kept Kate above tree line. And the longer she was above tree line, now it's not drive and determination. She's exposed to the weather. She's exposed to the terrain. And once hypothermia starts, you know, the colder you get, that affects your decision-making ability, your front prefrontal cortex, where, you know, that CEO function of your brain, executive function of your brain, you know, lack of blood flow to that part of the brain causes us to start to really, it hampers, impedes our decision-making.
No, absolutely.
And so what kept you out there in the first place is not necessarily what's keeping you out there. There's a shift that takes place. It's not the drive and the determination. Now it's impaired decision-making because of hypothermia, because of exhaustion, because of dehydration.
Right. And you're building up a sweat as you're going, and it's cooling you down because you're sweating. And as the slower you go, the more that temperature is affecting you and the decisions makings are becoming poor. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. There's, you know, you can talk to people all about it, but until they understand, you know, really what it is. And I don't know how many rescues. One of the first rescues I was on was Halpern, and that was in the Central Whites, Crawford Notch area. And he clearly got hypothermia because he shed his clothes going and was found in a brook sitting in the middle of the winter time. But he found a drainage, went down the drainage, and clearly was getting hypothermia because he was shedding his clothes.
Yeah, paradoxical undressing. Yeah.
Yeah, and then sat himself in the brook, and that's where we found him.
Yeah.
So it's, and you can see.
And that's not a rational mind.
Right.
You know, that's a hypothermic brain.
Right. And that's really hypothermic brain. And then certainly Kate didn't experience to that degree. I think she was able to fight, you know, a lot of that.
That's really, so she makes the decision to continue to Adams. You know, we'll never know if her intent was to continue with the entire traverse. You know, Charlie really believes that her intent was only to go to Adams because she didn't do Adams the month before in January when she wanted to. And, you know, just really emphasized that she was a rational person. She did think about risks. She had a plan. she had multiple bailout points set across the route.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you turn your back to that wind, and at some point she makes the determination that she needs to turn around and go back, which was the right call, but that call came really late.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to use your words, because I distinctly remember this quote that you gave to the Boston Globe, and Nestor Ramos wrote a really good article, The Young Woman in the Mountain, and you were quoted saying, you know, she was systematically trying to save her own life at that point, and she worked really hard to get back to Madison Call and Treeline, but got to a point where she was about 0.4 of a mile from Madison Hut, which would have at least provided mm-hmm. some barrier of the wind, and then another, so 0.3 of a mile to the Hut, 0.4 of a mile to Treeline, but gets to a point where as she's going back into that call, she's now walking back into a 90 plus mile an hour headwind, which is just impossible to penetrate, and activates an emergency beacon, as you know, and that launches what is a very a significant SAR operation.
No,
which you're going to speak to much better than I can, because you've lived that for years. So
yes, no, that's for sure. She gets to that point, and like and really she was. You know, could she have made other decisions that might have? Who knows? I mean, that was anybody that has walked into a heavy wind, and she was a slight girl, 120 pounds, 130.
5'4", 125.
5'4", 125. To walk into a 90 mile an hour wind, in search and rescue, we find people are driven. They put their back to the wind, and the wind pushes them. So.
Yeah.
When we do a search and rescue mission, we look at wind direction, speeds of wind direction, because that wind's going to push them, usually, to where we're going to find them.
Yeah, right.
Kate hunkered down and pushed into a 90-mile-an-hour wind.
Yeah, and I think, because it's, you know, you'll have listeners and I've had readers and, well, should never have been in there in the first place. And because I do think you saw her character in terms of how close she got to saving herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was completely relying on her own strength to get herself out of the situation. And, you know, as Charlie told, I think, Mark, you know, if she's activated that beacon, she knows it's a life and death situation. But I think that's the thing that we have to contend with here, because, you know, to hear me say that she worked really hard to get back, can be overshadowed by the criticism of being there in the first place, and
right.
So it's not black and white to me,
right? And there's critics everywhere,
yeah.
And there'll be critics about this podcast, and there's always critics, yeah. And that isn't
probably,
my intention.
Probably only
that,
probably just your guest.
And my intention is her DNA, her heart, to walk into a wind at 90 miles an hour and continue that for as long as she did. It just states what kind of person she was, and you know, that was a tough thing to do.
Yep, the person she was, again, I think drive and determination kept her out there, probably beyond her capabilities, just physiologically and experience wise. And I think those same traits had her almost very close to self-rescuing.
I would totally agree.
Yeah,
and I think Charlie, knowing his wife, certainly knew when that beacon went off, you know, that was, yeah, it was a life or death situation, because he knew her personality.
Yep. That she'd want to get herself out of whatever.
Exactly.
She
wasn't a kind of person that was going to rely on anybody else to rescue her.
Yeah. And that's where the title of the book comes from, Where You'll Find Me, Alan Clark, the president and founder of Pemi Valley Search and Rescue. You know, I was talking to him at an event I was speaking at, and he said, you know, based on everything I'd read and everything I knew about her, because Pemi wasn't involved in that particular rescue, it was out of their catchment area. He said, you know, when she activated the beacon, I don't think it was activating it, please come save me. She activated it. She knew it was the end, that she wasn't going to survive. And it was, she did it for the rescuers and for her family, that, you know, this is where I'll be. This is where this is where you'll find me.
No, and so. That's absolutely, I think it's a great thing you grasped for a title of a book.
Yeah, which I didn't even know I was writing at the time he said it. So it was just right. One of those things that happened along the way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a good thing, because of all the things you gleaned through it compelled you to write a book about this. And I think it's a good thing for people to read it. It's a good thing for us to comprehend it. And it's a good thing just to understand Kate and carry on, you know, her memory. So I think, you know, like I said in the beginning, any good you can come out of a bad situation, it is, you have to grab onto that. Survivors grab onto good things that come out of bad situations. And that's just being human. And that's what I hope everybody grabs out of your book is lessons learned. You know, even for people that are like Kate, for me, that, you know, thinks about that weather change and when you're out there. And absolutely, do I pack heavy? Yeah, because I know the equipment that can save me. And yeah. I always have a tendency to bring stuff for other people because that's what I've been doing for my whole career is helping save people. And so I carry that a little bit of extra that can, if I find somebody that I can here, have this.
Yeah, and I think some of the anecdotes that I've gleaned over the past 5 years, whether it's readers or people at sessions or what have you, and again, I'm not, I am in no way or will I take credit for these things, but that story, you know, I've had people say I'm changing the way I go into the backcountry. I am packing more. I mm-hmm. used to go fast and light, and there's nothing wrong with fast and light. Again, I think that's a gray area. And then one of the other things is that, you know, people that are going out into the backcountry, it's been shared with me that, you know, we're having conversations with each other around turnaround and what's driving us and why are we doing this that we normally haven't had before. And I think those are good things to come out of this. And the other part of the book that is as much the story, it's the search and rescue operation. And there are some remarkable stories within that rescue of rescuer experiences. And I really wanted to kind of shine a light on the work that gets done by the conservation officers, the Air National Guard pilots, Civil Air Patrol, and the ground personnel, many of whom are all, you know, they're volunteers. And they're just remarkable people, you know, and so committed to what they're doing.
No doubt. I remember getting that call from Sergeant Mark Ober, who was my sergeant that, and I always had this, I didn't really want to know the night before what was going on because you don't sleep.
Yep.
And Mark called me that night, which he knows I hate getting the call at night because I won't sleep. You know, call me at 5 a.m. to go out. Call me, but he calls me that night and says, hey, I just wanted to give you a heads up because I was off on Sunday and this was going to roll into Monday. And, you know, we've got a really bad one going on and I don't think it's going to get resolved tonight. So I just wanted to give you a heads up that we're going to have to roll out a lot tomorrow. And I'm like, okay. So again, I didn't sleep that whole night thinking of what tomorrow will bring, getting preparations to get a mobile command post from Concord up. I had Mark, you know, lining that up and telling him about what we needed in the next day. And he, you know, that's his job to manage that night and calling out officers and, you know, other search and rescues, MRS, and trying to make a rescue that evening and making the decisions when the wind gusts were over 100 miles an hour and temperatures were negative. You know, that's the stress of a search and rescue manager. I don't think a lot of people understand.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
And I'm working on a writing project right now that really, I think, dives into that role even more so than I did in the first book. Mark did he was managing a ton from the cab of a pickup truck.
Absolutely.
That's getting, you know, rocked back and forth by wind gusts in a parking lot. And, you know, the safety of the rescuers is paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this story is as much about the risk management practices and the decision-making of the people that were on the ground and in the air over that period of time and how they approach these things and the decisions they make and recognizing capability, self-awareness, situational awareness. I get into all of that. But yeah, I agree with you. And then Mark, as you know, he stayed out all night after, you know, phase one of the search that night concluded. He was out driving, and I'll never forget him telling me this, and I put it in the book, but, you know, he's driving trailhead to trailhead hoping that he's going to pull in and Kate's going to be standing there or that she's bailed off, you know, into Madison Gulf and comes out onto the road. And, you know, those are the things, those are the stories that people don't hear about. They read the headline, they make their judgment. You know, most of us, I think, feel empathy and then move on to the next story or the next task. And you don't hear about the what the rescuers go through, what the families go through, what the victim went through. And I think those are important parts. And who the victim was, I think those are important parts of the
story. I think that's why your book is so important. Podcasts like this are so important because we take the time to delve into that type of stuff. And you're right, Mark Ober did an awesome job managing that. And till the next morning when I met him at 6 a.m. and we're trying to find a location to bring that mobile command center in, and the parking lot was just a total whiteout.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what the wind speeds were, but I'm like, we need to find some place in the Lee. We can't run it out of this parking lot, Mark. So we went to the Randolph Fire Station, which was in the Lee, you know, when we had our mobile command station there. Plus, we had the fire department to work out, and they're just, you know, awesome people. That's not the first time we've run a search and rescue mission out of there. And it just works well to work with the local fire department on that.
Yeah, I think it was so cold. You know, Matt Holmes and Glenn Lucas and Bob Mancini they geared up in the fire department building just because it was just too cold.
And that was that night before with Mark. They were the initial
Hasty team,
as far as game wardens went.
Yep.
And then we had an MRS crew. Was it APSAR or MRS?
MRS, it was four
MRS.
Four MRS. And then four more came in to... they ended up bringing the litter
crew
up. They came up, the second crew, and left a litter up there and, turned around because the MRS one had turned around as well.
Right, because their intent that night was not to go above tree line. The way the spots, and I hate to use that word spots because that's a brand name. It's we don't want to use a brand name because these...
Yeah, this was not a spot.
Yeah, the personal locator beacon devices. There's several of them. Some go to the Air Force base, which this one did, and they manage those beacons. And then Spots has its own company that does that. So, but this personal locator, and I learned so much over this case over personal locator beacons.
Yeah,
because they have to be.
We talked a lot about it.
Yeah, it has to be deployed perfectly to give an exact location. This one gave us, I forget how many. It was, I think we were getting into over 12.
Yeah, so there were, you were, Fish and Game received 11 between 3:15 in the afternoon and 5:20 Monday morning. But it got to the point where Lieutenant Jim Goss, who's now retired, mm-hmm. he was also there. He told the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center, stop giving us coordinates until you can give us the right something. Because what happens is in those situations, you have so much information coming in, it impedes your ability to make decisions. And they were getting so many conflicting beacons. It was like, it was obvious at this point, okay, not many of these aren't real, as they were able to determine Sunday night when MRS-1 got to the location of the second beacon, which was probably the safest location to go to, although incredibly difficult to get to.
Mm-hmm.
But Civil Air Patrol, that's connected to the Air Force, had over 30 that the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center had provided to them. So it was just
30 different
beacon hits, and it was just crazy. But I think since then, you know, at the time, there were high Earth orbit satellites, there were low Earth orbit satellites. We didn't have the medium Earth orbit. And
eventually, Lieutenant Goss talked to somebody that was very familiar, and he said, give me one. He's like, the first one.
And that's where they went, and that was the right one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think satellite technology has gotten better in terms of the medium Earth orbit, or Earth orbit satellite stays on above the horizon longer, which should lessen these episodes of just having this, it's the wild goose chase.
Right.
Chasing hits, because as you know, every one of them has to be cleared.
Correct. And for us, it gave us something to do. Some of the ones below tree line were accessible because we weren't going above tree line in the wind and the weather. So those were assignments we could give. And we were hopeful that she had bailed off to these locations. So she was below tree line, maybe built a snow cave and, you know, was okay. So those were our hopeful ones. And when we sent, you know, teams to that because it was doable.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we geared up that next day. But let's go back to that first night because, you know, you did interviews from the officers.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't there. And, you know, that first night, you know, it's dark. We're talking, you know, over 100 mile an hour winds. It's negative 90. The decision was made by Mark, you know, in conjunction with everybody, not to go above tree line to try to clear these, you know, the personal locator beacons below tree line because that was the safety. But being that safe is we have to rely on our officers or the rescuers mm-hmm. on scene that live that. And again, we're fighting cold. We're probably fighting hypothermia, and we're fighting determined type A people, just like Kate.
Yeah. Well, I laughed just a short time ago because one thing I distinctly remember, because I remember interviewing Eric Fluett and Matt and Bob Mancini and Mark and Glenn Lucas. It was kind of like a one day where they were each assigned a time to meet with me. And I think it was at the Lancaster
office.
Yeah. And I remember sitting down with Glenn, and in the fishing game report, there's just one sentence that says, you know, Conservation Officer Lucas wasn't feeling well and turned around and came back down the mountain, and it gave his time. And
I might have wrote that.
Yeah. So I said, you know, Glenn, what can you talk to me a little bit more about this? Did you have the flu? Were you dehydrated? And he goes on to tell the story of how he's driving with this team. You know, when I say driving, I mean the three of them are hustling to get up there, and it's really, really cold. And he talked about how he had, I think from a layering perspective, he didn't wear quite enough because he normally doesn't, because you end up heating up quickly.
Right,
as you know.
You start sweating. And
the cold got to him quickly, and he got tired, and he started to fall behind, and he called the two back, and which I think is a pretty remarkable thing that he did, and it's a lesson that I've tried to extend his story onto others when I'm talking, because of we're talking teams here.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells them, it's not my night. I can't do this. I'm going to create a second accident scene, and you guys need to keep going. And I think about that. I mean, mm-hmm.
No,
especially in law enforcement, in public safety, there's a cohesiveness, and there's a kind of an unwritten aura out there that you perform, you show up, and you do the job. And
you never give up.
And you don't give up. And
And you always win.
That was such an important lesson. And when my jaw kind of dropped, I said, Glenn, do you realize the value and importance of this story? He's like, no, I don't. And we talked more about it. And he's since, I think, given a talk or two about mm-hmm. his own experience to
making good decisions.
Yeah, to teenagers, and which I think is a great audience for that. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, again, I think whether it's an organization or a team or a family, it's having that level of trust that the three of them had to not judge the decision that he made, and for him to feel that he could be vulnerable in front of them and say, tonight's not my night.
Right. And as search managers too, yeah. because we have an expectation that our teams are the best and they do this, and we give them an assignment that it's going to get done.
Yeah.
We need to accept it. We need to take the information that they have in the field and accept it.
Right. And I think the trust that exists between incident command and rescuers out miles away from them and making decisions in real time, it's, again, I just think there are great lessons there that translate into everyday life, just in terms of how that trust is developed, how that expertise is developed. And
it's because most of us have been there.
Yeah, exactly. But it's been a progression.
Right.
You know, I think about, I'd ask you if you reflected on who you were on your first rescue call to who you were when you retired, what changed?
Lots of lessons learned.
Yeah. What would you say changed for you over that period of time?
Yeah. Just knowledge gleaned.
Mm-hmm.
And when you say that, I keep thinking of that even towards the end of my career, I could have learned a few more lessons because you still have that in your system, that accomplishment that, you know, I worked with Border Patrol on a mission. It was -13. We got the snowmobile stuck several times. Created a ton of sweat. We're changing batteries out on the cameras on the border, and you know, and everybody kept saying their hands were cold, their feet were cold. My chest was cold.
Yeah.
And I kept saying my chest is cold, but I'm staying there. And finally, the supervisor says, "We're leaving. Me and you are going." And I said, "Why?" He goes, "Because nobody says their chest is cold." He goes, "I don't like that." So when we got back, I had frost on the inside of my jacket.
Yeah.
Built up.
That's
frost.
A good supervisor.
It's a very good supervisor. He made the right decision, and I tried to argue with him whether I was borderline hypothermia or not, but he's like, "No, Wayne, we're leaving." It's like, "I've never seen that. That's the second time you've said that, so we're going to go." And he made an excellent decision. But that was later in my career.
Yeah.
And I just you say you glean all these things, I've seen all these things, but when you put yourself in those positions, yeah, you may have a little extra equipment, you may, you know, you should know when to turn back, but it's still it's part of you that you fight yourself with those things. But I've
Especially as a first responder. I mean, there's a, I'm not going to say there's an expectation, because I think when you say that, you create risk, because you must go, you must mm-hmm. finish, you must win.
And, right.
And I think the first responder and public safety community in general has done a really good job of recognizing it. Those kinds of things have created challenges, have gotten people hurt or right. worse. And they just, again, do a really good job in really difficult circumstances of, yes, moving with urgency, but it's a methodical urgency.
And I think those are the things I've learned is, you know, when to cut off, not to create another search and rescue, not to put that limit there where you know that you can successfully do it. It may take more time. You may have to wait for a weather change. You may have to, ice, don't send an officer out on thin ice when somebody went through.
Yeah.
That's what we have, an airboat. So where we have a team, to know that person has probably perished, and, to try to deal with the family, the friends, when they want nothing more than you to go out there and find their loved one, when you know that, no, we have to put the brakes on and we got to do this right because they are gone.
Yeah.
That's the breaking point, and that's where I see, even in my own life, that, the extra casualties, don't, frame it up and make sure you respond to this correctly so there are no more casualties.
Right. So I think going back to the Sunday night, Bob and Matt continue up the mountain, up the Valley Way Trail. They set up kind of stage at, they're about 1,000 yards across from the site of the second beacon, which they decide that's where the teams are going to go. And just, the fuel in their packs froze. They had trouble getting a fire started because it was so windy. They're running up and down the trail and doing...
You have a jet boil that won't work.
Right. I mean, and doing jumping jacks just to stay warm, waiting for that team of four from MRS.
Yeah, this is extreme. And rescue, even in winter, this doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Guys don't grab their jet boil and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
They don't have to do jumping jacks to stay warm. This is extreme.
I would leave it to them to talk about whether, how close to that edge they were, but mm-hmm. Never been colder on a mission before. I think their voices, as you get ready to talk to them, will add a lot that I can't.
No, and we can talk about it, but we weren't there. We didn't experience it.
Right.
I've been in similar situations, because I've never been in a negative 90, and I'm sure below tree line it wasn't, but it was probably negative 60.
Yeah, it was cold. It was really cold. And that next morning, as you're getting the incident command post set up, I think winds were still between 80 and 100 on Mount Washington, and did start to ebb a little bit.
Crazy.
The ABSAR team that ended up locating Kate, again, just the way they went about making decisions and, huddling at tree line, which a lot of the teams do, and
mm-hmm.
gearing up, but also, I remember Mike, and again, I want him to tell the story, but, looking at his team and nine others and saying, if anyone's uncomfortable with what we're about to do, there's no judgment here, and they were with him.
Mm-hmm.
They made, just the way they made decisions about how far beyond tree line they would go and pairing up to monitor one another for frostbite and hypothermia, I think those are good lessons for whether you're a hiker or you're
Because those
not.
Things can change from tree line to, a quarter mile in to half mile in. You can change.
Yeah.
And
they tried to get into the Madison Hut because they wanted to make that a forward operating area until the wind dropped, and got there and the locks were frozen solid. They couldn't get inside, so they went to the lee side of the building and said, okay, here's what we're going to do, and they executed the plan. And I think, unfortunately, they found her. She hadn't survived, but I also think fortunately they did find her, because that was an important part of closure for them and for Kate's family. And
mm-hmm.
again, the things that people don't really read about or think about when they read about a missing hiker or a hiking accident.
No, because it spans just beyond the recovery of the person.
Right.
So.
Yeah, there were some rescuers that were really affected by that. One that read the book that was as part of that team of 10 that said the book brought him some closure, because he wasn't quite sure what it. He just got the call and went and executed the mission. Didn't know a lot about why it happened or what had happened the night before. And
Yeah, and generally we just give a general briefing. It's not very detailed. And then, reading a book, and I think it makes it more personable. And I think that's, you know, as a search manager, one of my, you know, I don't know if it was good or bad, but I worked with the families quite a bit in searches. You know, I had critical incident training, so that was usually me dealing with them. And you become bonded with these people. You become, you know, not so much with Charlie. You know, I didn't have a whole lot of it. You know, he was, yeah, he was, he's a strong, strong individual.
Yeah, but I still think about, and I wrote about this a little bit, you and Chad Miller went to deliver the news, and I didn't go too deep into that because it's a very personal, private moment, but I think probably wrote at a level that would just give people an understanding of the tragedy, that this was a loss, that, you know, a loved one was lost, and, you know, my heart breaks for him, and just the difficulty of you and Chad going to deliver that message, and I remember talking to you about that, and just, you know, Chad was really forthcoming about the drive over there, and, yeah, so I think about that a lot.
No, no, certainly, Chad, you know, that portion in your book I read, and as you know, he is very detailed, and, you know, boy, when you deliver news like that, it feels like your senses are heightened, and, you know, seeing the stuff from Valentine's Day, you know, certainly had an effect on Chad. It had an effect on me. You know, your heart wrenches normally, and it just had that extra wrench to that.
Yeah, I've delivered more than I've ever wanted to for notifications, and I've never heard it described as your senses are heightened, and it's, again, I really well said. I never thought of it that way, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're trying to feel the person out, too, to, you know, their normal reaction, but, you know, that's beyond that, too. It's their care as well that you got to be concerned with. You know, Charlie being all alone, he had relatives en route, things like that, you know, that's as a critical incident, you know, debriefer and stuff. That's, you know, I think of, you know, the person, there's a victim there as well.
Yeah. And I do think from a critical incident debriefing standpoint, I do think about the, you know, the mental health of particularly the volunteers. I think there's a structure in place for, you know, full-time folks from a debriefing standpoint. But I do think that's as first responder mental health becomes more and more of an issue. I think the volunteer searchers can't get lost in that.
No.
I think that's one thing I've talked to a couple of people about just through this 5 years, that we can't forget them.
No, I would agree, and I hope we try to include those. I know I've done some debriefings with volunteers, offered up
which
services,
which is, I think, important, and because they're not, you know, they're not doing what you and I used to do on a day-to-day basis. You go to these, I'm not going to say you grow calluses, but the more you go to, the more you...
It grows calluses.
I think get used to it's the wrong word, but you know, these are volunteers. They might be teaching school or running a small business or might be a guide, and they're not used to or acclimated to encountering, you know, a traumatic injury or a death in the backcountry. And because the backcountry for them is, they're all hikers and climbers, and, you know, that's their place. That's the place they're passionate about. And when it's disrupted by something awful, that space changes for a lot of them.
That's so important for a critical incident debriefer to not get callous, to step back, to, you know, feel the emotions of those families and feel for them.
Because, and I think that's what I've... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it attaches you, and I think that's important to become attached because you break that callous, so to speak, by becoming involved. And over that, with search and rescue missions, sometimes they're days. And, you know, I always like the family should be the first to be updated. And with social media, that's a challenge, I will tell you. The search and rescue for the next, from now on, it was a challenge when I left to beat the social media, to even death notifications. But, and then to work with them throughout that, because you want to give them up-to-date information as much as you can, as fast as you can. And then you become a part of, you know, you're the liaison. You're their rock. And that becomes... It becomes difficult, but if you don't become that, you lose sensitivity.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, I think, with this, again, where people are always going to judge, and I understand the judgment.
It's part of being human.
Right, and I think one of the things I've tried to, it's just the importance of empathy. You know, you can't tell me, the person that's coming from a place of criticism, if I ask you as the critical voice, so you're telling me in your entire life you have never done something that got away from you. You know, you've never made a series of decisions that led to a consequence that you didn't anticipate. I'm hard pressed to believe there isn't something there or a series of somethings there. But again, like you said, it's human nature. It's what we do.
Yeah, but you're right. That brings it personally to everybody.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you didn't pay the price that Kate did.
And it may not be extreme mountaineering or mountaineering in extreme weather.
Vehicle-related, always something. You know, yep. Snowmobiles. You know, just my experience with ATVs and snowmobiles. Even, you know, I had an ATV on a search and rescue mission that I hit a rock and I rolled directly over onto my back and it came back on all four wheels.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was, I guess I shouldn't have done that. But that could have had devastating, but didn't. You know what I'm saying? But that was a poor decision that had quite a reaction that, you know, thank goodness I didn't get hurt. But, yeah.
Well, and I think backcountry accidents and mishaps are magnified. Mm-hmm. I mean, in an urban environment, you drive a car, you make a mistake, you have an accident. Well, you have a seatbelt, you have an airbag.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully those things
mitigate. You have 911.
Yeah, hopefully those things mitigate consequence. You know, you get in trouble in the backcountry. Unless you know exactly what you're doing and you're hydrated and you're not hypothermic and you know how to use your gear,
right?
That you've used it before things went bad. You didn't just buy it and put it in your pack because I may need it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that seatbelt. You don't have that airbag. So the consequence is magnified. It's exacerbated.
And when you call for help, it's going to be a long way.
It's hours. Out. Yeah. As you know,
might have a helicopter involved, which, you know, is expensive. More so than an ambulance. And you're absolutely right. It gets magnified and that's for sure. So, wrapping this all up, I mean, reflections, you've run a book, you've been a speaker and you're still available to speak on this, aren't you?
Yeah. Just to go way back when the origin of all of this was I was putting together a short presentation for our annual risk management conference that was in May of 2015. It was at the Mount Washington Hotel, and it's our membership. So it's school, municipal, and county government from all over the state because we were risk pool. So we provide workers' comp and property and liability coverage to them. And we have a really heavy education and training component, heavy risk management component. We manage their claims. So I was taking something I was passionate about, which is mountaineering. And, you know, I've followed accidents like you and many others in the White Mountains for years. And I picked two cases, one out of, you know, my favorite book, Not Without Peril. And I was all set to go for this May conference. And then Kate's accident happens in February. And just as you said, the reaction to that story, I decided that I was going to add it to the presentation. And I wanted to look at these three cases in a really non-judgmental way and say, what lessons can we glean from these that might help us better make decisions or manage risk in the public sector? Because again, the process at 4,000 feet is the same here. The influences and the human factors at 4,000 feet are the same at sea level. And I thought I was only doing this one time. And so I did the presentation. I got asked to do it again, decided I was only going to focus on Kate's story because it was so compelling for people. Went back and just did more research over the summer, did it in September of 2015, had the GPS file by then, so it was much more visual and I could add much more detail. And I just kept getting asked to do it over and over and over again. And it, you know, I did it last week. I'm doing it next week. It's just a lot of what I'm doing is in our membership, but it's also I'm asked to do it outside the membership for hiking groups or, you know, business people or what have you. And I never expected that to happen. And all along the way, people, you know, at the conclusion of your presentation, they want to come up and share their own story of a near miss in the mountains or somewhere else. And then it's followed by, is there a book? I want to know more about Kate and the rescuers. Is there a book? Is somebody writing it? Are you writing it? And, you know, for over a year, it was no, no, and no. And then finally, you know, I think you were there, Colonel Jordan. I did the presentation for the command staff of Fishing Game, and Colonel Jordan handed me the entire case file, which opened up a whole
absolutely
series of information I didn't have before. And there were all these, I met the Black Hawk pilot at a session I was doing, didn't know he was there, and talked to him. And there were just these series of things that happened that, and, you know, I retraced the Kate's route with Mike Pelchat, who led the team that located her. And so to make a long, I've already made a long story long, but, you know, I finally just decided to commit to writing it. And I didn't want to write a sensationalized story. I wanted to write something that would hopefully be a resource for people, you know, recognize who Kate was as a person, recognize the commitment and the selflessness of the search and rescue community, and to have people take lessons away in situational awareness and decision bias and those kinds of things.
And I think you've done that. I think you've been able to, and I think spin's a bad word, but bring it to reality for all kinds of decisions made and make it actable to somebody that sits at a desk every day to risk and decision making and bring it to that, because it's part of our life.
It is. And I think people don't even realize how much of a part of your life it is. It's because complacency sets in and, well, I'm not bungee jumping, I'm not hiking, I'm not skydiving, therefore I'm not a risk taker, and I don't buy it.
No, I would agree.
And, you know, maybe there's, for those of us that are, you know, driven and determined, like you've said, you know, there are lessons to be learned from this, but I think there's also a lesson on the other side for the people that aren't and are more risk averse and more conservative, that, you know, maybe, you know, it's okay to get out of your comfort zone and embrace some discomfort and take some risks, because that's where we grow. That's where we develop experience and wisdom and expertise and specialize in things and build technical competency. So I think you can make the argument regardless of your behavioral style.
Right.
So, and I'm really grateful to you and to Mark and, you know, the CEOs and the search and rescue community that have trusted me to tell that story. And, you know, you could have shut this down when Mark approached you. So I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm certainly glad I didn't, because, you know, looking from the outside in and gleaning all that information the way you did and then doing a presentation on it, you know, it helps everybody involved, and it helps those people that aren't involved with lessons learned. And, you know, certainly Ty Gagne, Where You Will Find Me. You know, a tragic story, but again, take the good out, take out of a tragedy, find the good things in it, find the lessons learned, and then apply it to your life. And that's the most important thing we can do to move on and to remember Kate, I think.
Yeah, and you're not going to, if you're picking up this book thinking you're going to read a critical assessment in terms of criticism, that's not what this is about. That's not the intent. It's, you take the story, even though it's extreme, take the story and relate it to you. That's, you know, I want you to decide when the time to turn around was and how this relates to you. And are you driven and determined like you've assessed yourself, and or am I not? And what, again, what can I take away from it?
No, absolutely.
And thank you very much. I wish you all the best with this. It's
this is good. It's like another format, another facet of, you know, your writing. That's not my skill set. Yeah. Fish and Game, I think, developed me to be a talker.
Well, you're really good at it, and I don't mean that. I mean that as a compliment, and I've really enjoyed listening to these, and I think it's great what you're doing.
Well, hopefully we can continue your work and share this, and people can learn lessons learned. And, you know, if you can get Ty to talk at a training or something that's risk assessment or learning about this, you know, certainly reach out to him and reach out to me. I can put you in contact with him, because he's a dynamic speaker as well as a good author. And like I said, 5 times I've listened to the presentation, I've learned something different, because we have our blinders on when we are doing what we're doing in these search and rescues. We have our jobs, we do those, and we, you know, we don't experience things everybody experiences. But when you bring this all in, you do all these interviews, you wrap it all up and you package it, you give just a good evaluation and a good perspective, which I enjoy listening to you, and the book was outstanding. But I enjoy listening to you more, because I like to hear things more. And just like I said, 5 different times I've seen you, 5 different times I feel like I saw a different presentation, and I gleaned more from it.
So. Thanks. And that, I'm really humbled by that type of feedback, just because I have talked to search and rescue teams before as part of this. And, you know, to get that kind of feedback from the people who are out there doing it and experience these things is, means a lot to me. And that's why I just really focus on detail and research, because I want to get it right. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's important to get it right. And
I think you did, Ty. And you're working on something else now, huh?
Yeah, I have. It's another story out of the White Mountains, and I think with this particular story and the second coming back to something around the second time, I'm getting more access from the teams and that I didn't. I got
you built
really,
a relationship.
Well, yeah, I'm really happy for the access.
I know
got
who
last
you are
time,
now.
But people, I think, aren't like, all right, this maybe okay. This guy's reasonable, and so I really appreciate that. So I think, you know, I'm really looking forward to the story being told, and it's a story of tragedy, but also of survival, and I think that's. And I think it needs to be told because, again, it's remarkable.
And it sounds like we'll be doing another podcast on that.
Yeah, it should be out in the fall of this year. So
wow.
Thank you.
Good. Well, great, Ty. Thanks a lot for taking the time. And hopefully get the other officers to join in and make a great podcast out of this.
Yeah, I'll lay down the challenge right now for them to participate. So.
I appreciate it. I'll let them
not
know.
Not that that carries any weight whatsoever.
You'd be surprised. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.